All right, so I've got some notes for you, but I also want you to interject with details, comments, questions, and that should make for a pretty enjoyable 45, 50 minutes. I have this colloquium I'm hosting for the department, so I need to go set it up. I might break it like 4:25. Okay, well, let's see. So one way to think about this chapter is that it's kind of getting, so chapter 8 kind of is in this end of the time schedule. So let's start your notes here. He's filling in the last part of the history of human interaction with soil and really human relationship to food at that level. And so what do we learn? Well, we get some information about China. And we get some information about the U.S. Great detail starting the chapter. Remember that image of Tibetan farms where the animals can go out on their own to the fields and fertilize the fields? Some of you may have seen, if you drive across to Seattle, you may have seen cattle grazing on wheat stubble. That's pretty typical. But it's not organized the way. The image that's presented here is really kind of wonderful, which is a nice synergy between animals and plant agriculture. And that's kind of it's just an image he puts out there, but notice that at the end of the chapter he comes back to organic and alt and agroecology. And so that's kind of an image that is like a historical image that in the contemporary organic movement is still potent. Okay, I think the real work in the chapter begins, and there's this nice detail about a positive thing about Chinese agricultural production. Remember, last time we encountered this guy, Loudermilk, who went to China to help with famine relief and found this ancient site of mismanaged farming. So that's way back here. The detail you get here is that rice paddies are interesting ecologically because they have nitrogen-fixing algae. So he cites that as a sustainable dimension of Chinese production. But the contemporary story in China is that 1999, sorry, I'm missing a 9 up there, to 2003, crop yields are down 10%. So that's a concern. So the later story isn't better. That's the first point for your notes. Second point for your notes is, and this is a tough thing to explain. We tried to explain this last hour, and maybe you guys have some ideas. How do you explain the fact that the more humans know about soil and soil management, that knowledge about soil and soil management hasn't really helped much in the aggregate? If an alien came down in here and said, "Wow, you know, you humans, at the beginning of agriculture, you didn't know about soil management. Then you did. Remember, the Romans knew about soil management. They just couldn't follow it. They even tried to pass public laws to manage soil better." Then, you know, we learn in this chapter, we learn about the emergence of soil knowledge, real contemporary soil knowledge, ecologically based, science-based. And so the alien would be asking us, well, gosh, why do you humans have so much trouble converting knowledge about soil into practice? When I've heard that if you go to your doctor and your doctor has some new knowledge about how to cure your disease, you take the pill, right? Don't most of you follow the advice of your doctor? So generally, humans have done pretty well in incorporating new knowledge into their practices. So here's the question for you. Why is it that knowledge of soil health hasn't translated into better agricultural practices? See, we can speculate about that together. We have some answers from this chapter, but we also have answers from earlier reading. Who can start us off? We can get like a little list going. Why haven't humans been able to benefit from their knowledge about soil the way they've benefited from other kinds of knowledge, where it seemed like a no-brainer? Wow, antibiotics, great. Okay, no problem. We take too many maybe. But
I just feel like when they talked about Whitney, who was like in the government position, and versus whoever Whitney had. They had information that went against Whitney's belief. I think that's just kind of a natural human flaw that humans don't want to always accept something that they don't believe. And I think in something like soil, where if you did accept it, we'd have to make big changes. I think people tend to not accept.
Yeah, so big implications are hard to absorb. So there are big implications from soil knowledge, right? The first part of what you said is interesting, too.
Kind of like a conflict of interest.
What I focus on in that Whitney King, was it King? Was that the other person? King was fired by Whitney, but then the West Coast guy was this N. Who was that? No, it was somebody else. Hilgard. I'm sorry, it was Hilgard. One of the things I drew out of that was that we had a crazy default theory. And that doesn't help explain why we had so much trouble moving away from it. But, you know, we've had other crazy theories in human history that have taken a long time to disprove. For instance, Aristotle believed this. Aristotle believed that species were eternal. So that, you know, every animal and every human that you look at was always like that. Okay, you know, fair enough. Took a couple thousand years to get evolution in the books, right? So that's a crazy default theory in retrospect. But what was our crazy default theory about soils? Anybody remember? What did Whitney believe? He thought soil. Yeah, do you remember this?
Is he the one that wanted plowing, like always?
Whitney didn't think plowing was a problem. He didn't think you could deplete soil by plowing. And the default theory was that he and many others thought soil was infinitely fertile. Crazy. Oh, my God. You know, Marxists thought soil was infinitely fertile. Capitalist theorists. Go ahead and start your notes this way. You know, part of the explanation for resistance to soil knowledge is that we had this crazy idea that soil was... Now, you could say, well, why did we have that crazy idea? Okay, big implications to the knowledge, that's another part of it. How about short-term versus long-term? Right? The knowledge about soil management has implications for the long-term. Humans frequently have trouble managing short-term desires for gain against long-term sustainability. So that would fit. You know, if you were talking to the alien, you'd say, well, you know, we humans have a little trouble... you know, delaying gratification. So a farmer's tempted to get short-term gains. Also, you know, if I were a farmer and I was trying to feed my family, I'd be nervous. I'd want that money in the bank. Anything else? The last thing I'd add to your list would be the psychology of food. And I think our psychology of food is really different than a lot of our other psychological responses. I think we have a kind of a really accessible fear of not having food. There's a food writer who wrote a really interesting book called Fear of Food. And he said, he goes through many epochs of different cultures, and he says, there's just always, when humans have thought about the future of food, they've always expressed anxiety about the future security of their food. So the point I take from that is that we have anxieties about food that are unique and powerful, and they might keep us into short-term thinking. Does that make sense? I mean, I just find it hard to explain why rational creatures would take so long to incorporate this knowledge. We haven't done it yet. Although there's some positive stuff at the end of the chapter, right? We get the history of organic. I mean, he really brings us up to date in some interesting ways. He even brings us into the Northwest neighborhood, right? Did you like the mention of Spokane? Oh, we forgot to do our quiz. Should we do it?
No.
That was... What would we tell the other class?
Nothing.
Nothing. We all swear secrecy. You really don't want to do the quiz?
No.
You don't.
You were the one that just said at the start of the class that this is a really detailed test.
I know. But I found these great... Do you want to see the questions?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, sure, as long as you don't have to take it.
Yeah, let's
just... All right. Yeah. I was really proud of my questions. I'm really sorry I blew the quiz. Okay. All right, what about this one? This was too easy. See, now you're going to get mad at me because you're going to realize you could have gotten this one right. See.
Virgin.
Um, True or false? We should ask our guest. You got a 50-50 chance. No, how would you know that? False. It's true. Yeah, nitrogen. There were natural sources of nitrogen, but that's the one that we learned how to pull out of the air, right? The air is 78% nitrogen. And we'll talk about it. It's a good story. Little Fritz Hopper. What about this one? True or false? I was really proud of this question. I think this is a really devious so question. It's tricky, isn't it? No, it doesn't have to be tricky. If you know what the Green Revolution was, as it was discussed in the chapter, this is an easy question to get right. But you seem hesitant to say no. Okay, so no, the Green Revolution had nothing to do with organic farming. Okay. Let's make sure we get that from today. Is that okay? Okay. Anyway. Next time I won't judge you guys from your quiz. Okay, so let's go ahead and keep pursuing. So one theme in the chapter is that he's bringing us up to date, and part of getting up to date is learning about alt agriculture and organic methods and the emergence of soil knowledge and this. So this one actually includes all of these. So let's get into the more detailed ones. So we discover that soil amendments that have phosphorus in them are powerful, and so we find them in these guano islands off the coast of Peru, right? And we just mine the daylights out of them. Isn't that interesting? So the point for your notes would be that when humans find the two major single chemicals that can increase yields, they just go crazy to produce them. They find them naturally, and then they learn how to make them synthetically. Now, so that's part of this food psychology. So we don't stop to think, to listen to the people who are telling us that that synthetic nitrogen might be bad for the soil. We just know that we're going to get more food from this, so we just do it. And one of the remarkable facts to point out are extreme behaviors is that President Franklin Pierce passes a law called the Guano Island Act, which extraordinarily allows citizens to go claim islands of bird shit for the U.S. It's like you can claim it in the name of the U.S. and we can come in and mine it. And you have an example in the chapter of a culture that we just messed up completely by mining their island into obliteration. So this is under the category of how we react when we have a way to counteract the effects of our soil erosion. And the story about nitrogen is especially interesting. Some of you might want to look into this further. Fritz Haber was a German scientist, as you know from your reading, who figured out the industrial process in World War I for getting nitrogen out of the air. And as you know, that's useful for two reasons, right? It's useful for making fertilizers for crops and for making bombs, right? You remember Timothy McVeigh, our one of our local terrorists, who blew up a building in Oklahoma by driving a truckload of fertilizer into the basement and somehow exploding it. I don't know how you do that. But a cool detail about Fritz Haber, I heard this on a podcast, I can't remember where. He was married. His wife was also a scientist. You don't need this in your notes. It's just kind of a side point. His wife was also a scientist, and she was horrified when she realized that he was working to find a way to produce basically limitless explosives, right? Because synthetic nitrogen gives you both, right? And she was also not recognized for her scientific achievements. She contributed to this knowledge, but as a woman in science in World War I, she's just not getting credit. Sad story. I don't like to tell sad stories, but it's a really poignant detail. She winds up, in her horror about her husband's program of developing these explosives, she kills herself. She's horrified that he would devote himself to that mission, and eventually she commits suicide. It's very sad. So sorry about the bad sad story, but there are some really interesting stories behind every one of these details. Okay. Anybody have any other details, questions about the nitrogen phosphorus? The point for your notes about phosphorus is that originally mining phosphorus and putting it on your crops doesn't work. It's not available to the plants. But then the industrial process we learned about was that if you treat it with sulfuric acid, it becomes bioavailable is the cool term to use, right? All right, so let's take a look at the emergence of soil knowledge and historically, let's get a couple of notes on that, and then that'll lead us into the Green Revolution and the organic movement and the alt-ag movement, and there's some really interesting stuff there. So the chapter ends, you know, this is a very negative thesis that Montgomery has, and you see it in chapter 10. He's going to draw, we'll get there, but he's going to draw out the implications of this thesis, and so we'll get there, but right now we need to kind of track the, still part of the negative story, but we're going to have a positive part of the story pretty soon here. Okay, so, sorry, not quite there yet. So the story about Hilgard and Whitney is interesting. So Hilgard is goes west, and he starts to understand that you don't just need nitrogen and phosphorus, you need manure, you need to build the health of the soil. Whitney, who's head of the USDA, so this is the point for your notes, there's a conflict of expertise between Whitney and Hilgard. Whitney has this crazy default theory that we've identified that soil is inexhaustible. Can you imagine the 1901 head of the USDA thought soil was inexhaustible? And the conflict is between him and this guy, Hilgard, who's starting to understand from working on problems of salination in California that, no, you really need kind of rich organic material for soil. Okay, so as we're discovering these wonder chemicals that are going to partly fuel the Green Revolution, we have other experts, this is the point for your notes, we have other experts who are quietly working on soil problems that are leading them to the right conclusion, which is that soil is a living material. It needs to be replenished with living material. Okay, so that's kind of a little political fight that kind of underscores how the emergence of this soil knowledge was contested. It was politically fraught. So it's a nice connection to our earlier study about the politics around the contemporary industrial food system. All right. So let's get let's talk about the Green Revolution, then we'll get into the organic movement. So what is the Green Revolution? Let's get a definition of it in your notes. What are the main characteristics of the Green Revolution? It was not a movement in organic farming.
It's kind of a movement in like chemical fertilization.
Right.
Getting really high yields.
Synthetic nitrogen and phosphorus are part of the method. High yield strains of wheat and rice. And the guy who did, this was an amazing thing. This was Norman Borlaug, got the Nobel Prize for this. And so what were some of the effects of the Green Revolution? Sounds like a good thing. It really did increase crop yields tremendously. Let's look at short-term effects, and let's have two categories of effects, short-term effects and long-term effects. How did the Green Revolution change farming in lots of places? Well, if you have to buy fertilizer, and you have to use a machine to spread it, and you also have to buy gas for the machine, one thing we could say is that the Green Revolution raised the capital inputs for agriculture, made it a more capital-intensive activity. But of course, you were getting these incredible yields, so no problem, no brainer. Buy some equipment, buy more fertilizer, right? Over and over again, I just want to kind of interject this here. Over and over again, when you read stories about farming in the U.S. in the last 30 years, they divide into people who got bigger and followed this Green Revolution model, and they're still making money. People who got bigger and sometimes they're making money and sometimes they're losing a lot of money because there's a lot of capital inputs, and if they get a bad year, they're in trouble. And third category, people who got off the bus. People who decided that they couldn't stay in chemical agriculture And one story, you know, I've told you about this goofy titled book, Lentil Underground. It's a really good book. It's about some Montana farmers in the 80s who couldn't get into the first category. They were in the second category, where sometimes they were making money, sometimes they were losing money, lots of oil, lots of chemical inputs. And the folks in this Lentil Underground story eventually succeed. They have some failures. And the guy behind most of it is Timeless Seeds. And like Shepherd's Grain, the way this succeeds is when somebody goes organic and then engages a lot of other farmers to supply, right? It's a great story. It's a great business story. It's a great organic farming story. And I gather that this is also true with Shepherd's Grain. You know, whoever organizes Shepherd's Grain, right, gets other farmers like your uncle to grow.
Yeah, I don't really know a lot about it, but
yeah.
I just know a couple years ago he started giving all of his grain to the companies.
Yeah, if you have an occasion to communicate with them, ask them about it.
Yeah, there was an article that came out last year in some magazine, so I'll find it.
A regional thing there?
Yeah, and there was like a video on my uncle.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, cool. I'd like
to
hear about that. Yeah,
yeah.
That's neat. So Lentil Underground is the story about Timeless Seeds. Maybe you'll tell the story about your uncle.
Yeah.
Okay. So short-term effects of the Green Revolution, increased capital inputs. Some farms get bigger and more profitable, but in many places, small farmers can't compete. Remember in our documentary, we had the image of U.S. corn production putting Mexican corn farmers out of business, right? So then they come across the border to work in our meatpacking plants, and then INS kicks them out for being illegal. Okay, so those are short-term effects. Movement towards larger farms, dispossession of small farmers who can't compete. High yields mean lower prices, so if you're not using the new methods, you're producing crops that just can't be sold. It just costs too much. So it's kind of like, you know, so what about long-term effects of the Green Revolution? There's one big long-term effect from the reading that you should pull out. Does the Green Revolution create... Yeah, please, to this folks.
I think it's just kind of moving the issue to another thing, because you're replenishing the soil nutrients, but now you're using oil, and they talk about how oil is not going to
Oh, good.
Be there.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry, I was forgetting. We got more than one long-term effect. So first long-term effect is sustainability, obviously. Right. Oil, dependence on oil has a long-term dimension. Yeah, good. Thanks. Other long-term effect? How long did it take us to outrun the, how long did it take us to eat up the extra food produced by the Green Revolution? Do you remember that detail in the chapter?
Oh, our growth population is
I think
extremely fast rate.
Right. I think by the 80s? By the 1980s, population growth consumed crop yield growth. So the point, there's a population problem with the Green Revolution. It was intended to solve world famine. I remember I was a kid during this time, and I was like, you know, I'd read these things. You know how kids overreact? They're like, you know, what if there's too many people? What if there's a population explosion? And there was a lot of fear about that then. And that's perennial. It keeps coming up every few years. But I was always told by my elders that, don't worry, we've got it under control. We have these incredible fertilizers. We're growing more food than ever. The Green Revolution. And it was really impressive. It was a huge increase. What did we learn? Yields doubled, I think, in a decade. They doubled maybe for two decades. I don't remember. Did anybody find that detail about about the actual effects? Okay. But the downside is it wasn't sustainable. A slight digression. I think we're doing okay on time. I used to take students to a study abroad program called the Benin program, because there's a West African country called Benin. And it was originally a nursing engineering program, and then I got involved. We had some humanities folks involved. Great program. It lasted for about 8 years. Then you may remember some years ago there was an Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Kind of made it hard to continue the program. It took a couple of years for that to kind of work through. And then, you know, frankly, a lot of parents weren't thrilled about sending their kids to a place that had Ebola. So the program kind of died, which is unfortunate. But one of my memories that this, you don't need to take notes on this. Just one of my memories of it that really plugs in here is the Songhai Center. And you could pull up the Songhai Center if you're curious about it. It was run by this Dominican priest who was a scientist, who was an engineer, and he started it in the 80s. And it's basically a demonstration project for sustainable agriculture in the third world. And it's won UN recognition as a center of excellence. He does incredible stuff. And one of his design principles is no fertilizers. There's no store-bought fertilizers anywhere in sight. You know, there's fertilizer that's been made organically from, like, compost. But his vision for African farmers is to stay off oil dependence, right? So you're dependent on oil from the fertilizer because it takes oil to make the fertilizer, and you're also dependent on oil for farm inputs. He's a really remarkable guy. Okay, so moving forward then, the next section kind of gives you data from different studies. Let's start your notes here. Data on the, we have stuck the Green Revolution here. Data on comparing organic and non-organic farms, right? Some of us have some connection to farm economies, but most of us don't. And when I grew up thinking, well, organic's more expensive, the yields are lower, and farmers do say that, okay? So anecdotally, I still think there's a lot of farmers I've read in print saying, you know, they took a hit on their yield. These research projects suggest that it's really comparable, that it can be comparable if you do it right. And we have a couple local heroes here. Oh, we have one local hero here. Wash U in St. Louis, right? So Barry Commoner is a really famous agriculturalist or environmentalist, and that's one of the studies. But another really important study, one of the early studies, was from this guy, John Reginald, who's a soil expert at WSU. And he gives a TED talk about this. And this research was done on farms near Spokane, as you read in the article. Well, that's kind of a neat local detail. I'm sorry, we also have the local story of Quincy. Wasn't that horrible? Do you remember that one in the chapter? Quincy, Washington? Where Quincy, Washington is? It's near where the amphitheater, the Gorge Amphitheater is. So that's just a sad environmental story, but... So first result for your notes, there's considerable research that says that organic farms can produce comparably to non-organic farms, but I'd also add that there's plenty of farmers who will tell you that they don't get the same yields. Whether they get the same, now notice, yield and economics can be different, right? So the yield, is that where you were going?
I was just
going
to ask, yeah, does sure. that mean you make as much money?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's, I think that comes up in some of these studies. You get... You may produce less food, but notice you didn't buy as much oil
mm-hmm.
in the form of fertilizer and oil and gas. Right. Good. Other details to throw in here?
Well, I would say I've worked with organic blueberries.
Oh, cool.
Conventional blueberries.
Right.
From previous jobs. And
good.
Organic blueberries are a lot more expensive to process.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
you can lose them a lot more, at least on
uh-huh.
the fresh
right.
end. They have a shorter shelf life.
Oh, right. That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, there are considerations that make organic food more expensive. Could be. So in this case, that's a good thing to bring up. In this case, it's not the growing, it's the handling. Organic foods are going to be, they're not from varieties that are selected for transportation, right? Think about that tomato that's been selected to withstand a 35-mile-an-hour impact from the harvesters. You know, so yeah, good point. I guess what this research is meant to persuade us of is that it's not radically less productive, or it's not radically, the economics aren't radically bad, even if you're producing a bit less food. Okay, let's see. All right, then we get into, okay, so a big distinction I want you to get then is between organic and, I'm calling it alt ag, it's also agroecology. So organic can be defined generally by the absence of pesticides and herbicides, right? But knowing that something's organic doesn't tell you that it was grown in soil that was managed well, right? So you have plenty of organic products coming out of California on farms that are eroding. the next to move to a more to move to agroecology is to take is to see. To see, how does he put it here? It's great. There's a great line here. It's to see the soil as part of a living system. He says it really well here somewhere. Let's see. Well, I'll just say it then. So here's the point. This is really important because it connects with nutritionism. An organic method can still focuses on chemicals. Agroecologists don't reduce agriculture to chemical inputs. They see agriculture as part of a set of dynamic and local ecological relationships between soil, climate, and geography. Does that make sense? So I'll say it again. Organic methods simply involve organic methods are expressed in terms of specific chemicals that are acceptable or unacceptable. Agroecology is about a more fundamental way of thinking about the soil as part of a dynamic ecology with weather, climate, geography. Does that make sense? And the difference, for example, is that you can get a food from an organic farm that doesn't taste very good. Because just knowing that it doesn't have pesticides or herbicides doesn't tell you anything about the properties of the soil that give food flavor. I want to learn more about this, but there's a kind of pretty obvious flavonoids. There's a category of chemicals called flavonoids that we attribute the flavors of our food to. And there's plenty of research that suggests that that really rich live soil has flavonoids that organic soils may not have. So the point for your notes is that organic methods can still be part of a way of thinking about the soil in terms of simple chemicals, whereas agroecology is about thinking about the soil as part of an ecosystem. Right? So it's a movement in that direction. And the connection I wanted to make to nutritionism, did anybody see the connection to nutritionism? Remember nutritionism a few weeks ago? Nutritionism, let's line it up in your notes. Nutritionism is seeing food as a vehicle for nutrients. Traditional agriculture involves seeing soil as a collection of chemicals. That's the parallel, right? So the point for your notes is that both are forms of bad reductivism, right? Sometimes it's good to be reductive, right? Sometimes you learn, you know, a lot of scientific discoveries depend upon reducing complex problems to simple ones. That's how you get antibiotics. But bad reductionism is when you reduce something that's complex to something simple and you miss what's important. And agroecologists will say that's what traditional farming does. It's the agricultural equivalent of nutritionism. Does that make sense to you guys? Are you with me? Okay, good. Okay, we're almost there. Okay, so we've done that. That's good. So in the category of agroecology, you've got some really interesting potential projects. There's Wes Jackson and the Salinas Institute, the Land Institute in Salinas, Kansas. Just want to mention what they're up to. They've been working for, I think, a decade now on no-plow wheat. So think about this. If originally wild wheat was wild, you didn't have to plow to plant it, right? But the productivity of the wheat was very small. In other words, you couldn't feed that many people on wild wheat. So we made strains, high-yield strains, right? And what Jackson's doing in the Land Institute is he's trying to cultivate high-yield, no-plow wheat. This is a really cool idea. Let's get it in your notes. I think you want to come back to this. He's trying to cultivate high-yield, no-plow wheat. If he succeeds, it would be pretty remarkable. You could basically treat a wheat field like a perennial field, just like the original wheat fields that we plowed up in the Midwest. And it reminds me of a story I don't think we tell in the course, the story of the emergence of modern corn. Some of you may know this already, but wild corn is really tiny and it doesn't have that many kernels. You guys know that's good. It came up in our reading, I think, maybe, I don't know. there's a story to tell. Yeah, in our reading, we had this when he went to Mesoamerica, I mean, in his account, we learned that it was 2000 BC when corn modernization, modern corn comes in, and that's when the Mayan civilization grows because there's more food. So no plow wheat might be like, this is the hopeful future. This is the end of the chapter, which is the hopeful future. No plow wheat might be like modern corn. Modern corn is fantastically more nutritious. I mean, even the intermediate forms had like 8 rows of kernels. Modern, you've seen modern corn, right? It has lots of nutritious kernels. So maybe the point for your notes is maybe agroecology will give rise to high yield, no-till crops, which would really be good for soil erosion. You also learn in this chapter that the Food Security Act from the 80s and 90s do require, this is good news, right? We've looked at a lot of bad news in the course, so this is kind of nice, do require conservation plans for farms. So you could imagine that we're moving in the right direction in that sense. Okay, that's most of what I had meant to cover in chapter 8. Are you guys have questions about any of this? Do you see do you feel like you're seeing the big picture here? I mean, if you look at the broad history he's telling, it's pretty dark until you get to some of these contemporary thinkers who are really trying to create new methods. Okay, so the last thing to bring in here is chapter 10, which is his last chapter, right? He's going to try to talk about his thesis at a very, in the broadest terms. Okay, so just a couple of notes. I think, you've read this. I just want to kind of bring out a couple of things and see if you have some reactions to them, maybe. So where he winds up, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, maybe you resist this, feel free to, where he winds up is saying the only way to solve this problem is to think about food and population together. That's the point for your notes, right? Ultimately, there's two main theses in our reading here. One you know already, soil erosion, soil mismanagement accounts for the fate of civilizations, right? That's a pretty huge thesis, right? And we've been reading chapters that document that. His other huge thesis is we'll never figure this out, we'll never make progress unless we think of food production and population production together. Because so far, every improvement that we've made in food production has led to population increase. And as empires try to manage that population increase, all kinds of problems occur, like colonization, expansion, war, right? So somebody should fact check this. He says the National Catholic Bishops say that maybe the planet could hold 40 billion. That's just insane, as far as I can tell. I mean, he says it's out there. Did they really say that? No, maybe they said that a long time ago. I don't know. Anyway, somebody could check that out. His point is the ecologists will tell you that, according to him, they'll tell you that if you wiped out all other life on the planet, you might be able to sustain 15 billion. So the point for your notes is what is the carrying capacity? Not the absolute carrying capacity. What's the carrying capacity at a sustainable level, assuming we don't want to cut down all the rest of the forests, right? What he's suggesting is we haven't come close to addressing that, embracing the problem at that level. And he makes some really interesting points here. He says Marxists haven't, capitalists haven't. Marxists and capitalist thinkers historically have bought into this crazy default theory. This is called the crazy default theory, that the soil is eternally inexhaustible. Oh my God. So the point for your notes is we don't have good political resources. We don't have good political theory on this because the two major kinds of political theory that really there's several others, but the two major kinds, capitalism and socialism, both embrace this crazy default theory. So you've got to look at how much soil is being produced, maybe an inch every 1,000 years on average. You've got to look at how quickly we're using it up, maybe in 40 years? Yeah, please.
I thought it was an interesting point, I think, in chapter 8.
Yeah,
how good. They talked about the amount of food we have now would probably sustain everyone on Earth. It's just a matter of the redistribution of the food.
Good.
And I think that ties in with that political structure, like how if we have all of this food,
right?
How do we? That's like also part of the.
Yeah. So good. It's a good thing to bring in. So there's not just food production versus population, but it's there's food distribution issue. It's also a political issue. Yeah, good. Others? Yeah, neat. One of the features of the modern problem, once you get to now, is that there's just not that many places to go. I mean, historically, we've had the capacity to move on, explore new territory. Now we've reached kind of a global limit. Like I said, unless you want to cut all the forest down. You might have heard this already. How many of you have read this kind of thing? This is from National Geographic. Plenty of other experts have said this. In the 5 years prior to the Syrian civil war, there were 5 years of crop failure. Now, that's induced by climate change, probably, but notice, even if you don't believe in climate change, Montgomery has given us evidence that cultures that didn't manage their soil are more vulnerable to climate fluctuation, right? So all you need to make this connection is that there was a fluctuation in the climate, it did cause crop failures, it did lead to a civil war, it did create a vacuum of power which allowed some really bad people, you know, to come in and set up shop, doing horrible things to people. And so this is, for your notes, this is one of the most recent instances of what Montgomery's been arguing throughout the book, that the story of soil and climate, the story of our management of soil, is incredibly predictive of geopolitical problems, including empire collapse. I think he makes the point really powerfully. And adding this in as a recent data point, to me, really kind of brings it home. So I don't mean to make it sound like everything's about food, but Montgomery makes a pretty good case that we should be looking at food as a causal factor in a way that we haven't, right? And then the last thing that I had in mind, oh, if there's questions about that or things you want to bring in, add detail, or let's do it. But he brings us to an interesting point here that we really need to be taking that seriously. So the last thing I wanted to add was really just a detail on this little schema that I seem obsessed about. And I just wanted to suggest that all roads lead to soil. And you might not think about it. Well, let's think about it together. So where is this going to happen? How are you going to achieve that nutrient balance? How are you going to have food that you can do this with if it doesn't have the nutrients? And what's going to determine that? It's going to be the soil, right? And what's satisfaction? Remember we said that one of the pillars of my food philosophy is satisfaction or gastronomy, right? The pleasure you get from food. Well, part of that pleasure is in preparing high-quality food, but part of it is in these flavonoids that exist in food that was grown in good soil. So satisfaction leads to soil. And you might think, well, practices... Those are independent from the soil. Those just have to do with cooking, things like cooking and sourcing food from Safeway or wherever you get your food. But let's break it down a little bit. There's individual practices, which are those things like what I cook, how I cook, whether I cook, where I get my food, what my local food economy is like. Is it a food desert? Is it a food jungle? But then those individual practices are determined by local food systems. Maybe you live in a place that doesn't distribute good food to your locality. And then that, you can see where I'm going here, that depends upon, larger food systems. And those food systems take you back to the soil. So your practices with food depend upon access to food that comes from good soil. So I'm in a frame of mind today where everything goes back to soil. Maybe I've been influenced by Montgomery too much. What do you think? Comments, criticisms, maybe skeptical doubts. If you buy this line of thinking, we should be pretty aggressive about wanting our soil to be managed as a collective resource. It's not just somebody's property, right? What do you think? Are we there? Okay. Okay, thanks a lot for your attention. See you guys next week.